Roger. 760 KFMB presents It's Your Money and Your Life. For the next hour, Richard Muzio and Joe Vecchio will educate and inform you on matters related to your financial future, your life, and your leisure. Now, with It's Your Money and Your Life, here are Richard and Joe.
Hey everybody, my name is Joe Vecchio, your co-host, announcer, and producer, coming to you live from La V with 50,000 watts of power. We're heard not just in San Diego County, but Orange County, L.A. County, up the coast of Seattle on a good night, out to the desert. If you've got the app for AM 760, you can hear us on your smartphone. You can hear us on 760kfmb.com. And now time to introduce the main man of the hour. He's a CPA extraordinaire. He's a marathon runner, very accomplished. He's a family office expert to several high-net-worth families and a best-selling author. And his name is Richard Muzio. Richard, good evening. How are you tonight?
I'm having a good night. So I guess that means we're reaching Seattle.
We are. You've got some friends up there, right?
Yeah, they listen occasionally.
Yes, yes.
Live in Redmond. Yeah, yes. Just next door to Seattle.
But we are back. We are
live. We are live. Yeah, we're at La Vie. We're actually live from La Vie.
We are tonight. And in the house to start the show is the august and accomplished and the wonderful wine director, Tammy Wong. Tammy, good evening. How are you tonight?
I'm fantastic. And I'm august. That's amazing.
Yes. Very good.
Welcome, welcome. We're drinking some Beaujolais Nouveau tonight.
Yes, tell us about this one.
One of my favorites. So Jean Foyard is one of the best producers in Beaujolais. It is a star in Kermit Lynch's portfolio, and they don't even list it in their catalog. You have to know to ask for it. Mm. He only makes enough of this wine to sell their pre-sale orders. Mm-hmm. It's organically farmed and hand-harvested from 40 to 60-year-old vines in Morgon, and it's really special. It's the new wine of the harvest. We're celebrating youth and freshness and deliciousness, and drink it as fast as you can. We only have about a case left.
This is the real French wine from France. Yeah, this is the real deal here.
It's the real deal. It's light and fun and fresh and holiday deliciousness.
Nothing but excellence here at La Vie. And now, tell us about Café La Rue.
Café La Rue, we're getting close. We're getting close. My wine vault is almost done. The doors are up. The shelving is on the way. It's going to hold about 1,000 bottles. We're going to have a great big refrigerator and have all our whites in there and our champagne. And I'm really excited about our new by the glass list. We're going to have some really fun, delicious stuff. And we expect to open in, hopefully by the end of the year, hopefully by Christmas.
Yes.
Hopefully by the end of the year. It is going to be beautiful. You have to come in and see it.
Well, the place is beautiful now with all the wonderful decorations and the live music every night. It's just terrific, the ambiance. So congratulations in advance.
Yeah, thank you.
Folks, you can see in. It's the old Whaling Bar, folks. If you come here, you can't quite get in yet, but you can see how magnificent it's going to be, and you can have a nice glass of wine or dinner here while you do that. But thank you very much.
Absolutely.
Tammy.
Thank you very much. Yeah, I'll see you soon.
Yeah, we'll have you back again to fill us in. But now to get to our guests on the show tonight. Full disclosure, I've known these guys, one guest for very many years. I've met his wife only recently, but our guest tonight has a very interesting career. He was a Navy veteran. He's probably one of the top trial lawyers in the entire country. Had some very huge cases, which we can talk about a little bit. Trial lawyer of the year multiple times. Originally from the East Coast, but I won't waste a lot of time. He's also a cancer survivor, so that's where we're going to talk about all that stuff tonight. But his name is Brian Monahan, and Brian, good evening. How are you tonight?
Thank you very much. I'm glad to bring my wife here, Jerry.
Yes.
She's going to carry me on this.
Yes, story. And Jerry is the other half of this. Jerry is started to work in Brian's law firm, I believe, in 91, 95?
In 91.
91.
And I made myself indispensable,
right.
So he had to marry me in 95.
You guys are the best dressed guest we've had, so I guess you're on your way to a holiday party, right?
Right.
We are indeed.
But Jerry helped Brian. Brian was diagnosed with brain cancer in 98, and we'll get into all the particulars, but Jerry stepped up and became his wife and his advocate, and he was given very little chance of survival, and through the miracles of love and medicine, he's here tonight. They are both here tonight, so we are honored to have you here. The book, they wrote their first book, The Power of Two, came out in 2009, and now it's being reissued under a title called When a Loved One Falls Ill. You can go to whenaLovedOneFallsIll.com to learn more about the book. But where do we begin? Brian, let's talk about your legal career first. You came to San Diego what year?
Well, I got here. The Naval Academy sent me here in 62.
Mm-hmm.
And then after 5 years, that was the Vietnam years, so I spent some time over there. And then I went to law school at Hastings for 3 years and came back to San Diego in 1966. 70, mm-hmm. joined a large law firm here mm-hmm. and spent loose forward Hamilton Scripps for 5 years and then went wow. on my own.
Okay. Then you became one of the premier, I guess, what were your main specialties?
I was a trial lawyer. I was a plaintiff's trial lawyer.
Well, that's true. Yeah. Well, I remember the legendary case you had. Was this your first big, I mean, Saul Price became your dear friend all those years, but what year was that case where you represented him and won that huge award for him?
I think that was probably in the early 80s.
Yeah, something like that. And that was, I think it was like $6 million or something or more. You recall the number? It was a big number.
Oh, they're such large numbers.
But after that, you and he had become close friends.
Wonderful friends.
Like yeah, father, son almost, right?
He and Jerry and I were with him every week.
Chance you could get. And, yeah. So you had lunch once a week with him, and many, many of those lunches or dinners were right where we are tonight.
And
right?
We traveled a lot with him, too.
Really? Yeah. Okay. So wow.
We came here basically every Wednesday. We would pick him up and have lunch here at La Vie.
Mm-hmm. And he had his office across the street, I think, right?
So, correct.
Yeah, outstanding. But anyway, let's move it toward 98. You had this wonderful, legendary law career, and what were the first symptoms when you you thought you were having some kind of a medical issue?
Well, it was May of 1998. Mm-hmm. I was, in my view, I was at the top of my game, both mm-hmm. professionally and personally. Mm-hmm. Jerry and I had just gotten married just 3 years before that. I had been single parent for 17 years and Jerry for about 15 years.
Wow.
And we were really starting our new life together. Mm-hmm. The practice of law was great. I was thoroughly enjoying, I loved what I did. Mm-hmm. I really did. One night I got a phone call, one day at the office, we had a meeting, and I had got a call from the doctor, a doctor we know well, Dr. Dan Einhorn. And he said, I want you to come to my office right away. I had just had some MRIs and CAT scans earlier.
Huh.
And but don't drive. Huh. He said, don't drive twice.
Really?
And I knew I had some trouble. I was shortly to find out that I had melanoma. I was stage 4, and they told me I had 3 to 6 months to live.
Were the CAT scans and the MRIs planned, or was that just part of a regular physical?
No, that's where the advocate, that was my first okay. step as an advocate. Brian was in a 4-month trial, and during that trial, he was even more exhausted at night than he usually was. Not only that, but this famous Irish storyteller was forgetting the endings of stories.
Wow.
We had just finished the closing arguments, and that night he couldn't remember the story that he had told in closing argument.
So
I knew something was wrong, and I made him go for his annual physical, and he went by himself. That was probably a mistake because he probably did not tell the doctor all the symptoms that I saw.
Mm-hmm.
And the doctor said he was just having
stress,
little issues that older people. But he was only 59.
Right.
I knew there was something wrong.
Yeah.
I called Dan Einhorn, and Dan arranged the MRIs.
Is he a neurologist, Dan, or is he just
He's a friend. When I said, Dan, there's something wrong he can't add, that morning I sat down on the bed and said, Brian, what's 52 and 11?
63. I'm sorry.
You're safe. You're safe. You're good to go.
No one asked you.
But that was what made me call Dan. The MRI showed 2 brain tumors, and
wow.
that's where we started.
Wow. Well, typically, now, you would think you would caught it early, and they say 85% of cancer is beatable if you catch it early enough. Now, of course, I don't know which types and how early is early, but anyway. Well, thank God.
I had it both in my brain and also in the lymph nodes as well. And with the combination of those and having had one on my back before that,
mm-hmm.
they said you're stage 4.
From the melanoma. Were you ever severely sunburned as a child? Do you remember getting severely sunburned?
Sure, I grew up in Philadelphia.
Okay. Because I think I read once, if you've had 2 really bad sunburns in your life, you're a pretty good candidate to have some kind of skin cancer. But I just
That's
curious.
A big problem in Australia.
Really? Mm-hmm.
Enormous problem.
I can imagine. So you were diagnosed, and then what was the next? So Dr. Einhorn said, he issued this report, and obviously you must have been emotionally wrecked, right?
Well, we walked out the door, and as we walked out, say what Dan said to you.
Dan gave me the words of wisdom. He said, courage. He knew we were going to need it. But we got to the car, and we hugged each other. it's almost as if you've been hit in the stomach when you get news like this. Huh. And I said to Brian.
So he didn't tell you until you got to his office?
Right.
Okay.
And that was a way of kind of breaking it into us. We knew, I knew there was something very, very wrong when he said, go pick up Brian, don't let him drive, and come to the office.
Huh. So the next step, I know you had some major surgeries and treatments and, you know, experimental.
Well, we did quite a bit of everything. We had, we spent, most of what we did was in San Francisco, and I had a craniotomy. I had two craniotomies. I had Yama knife first, then I had two craniotomies, then they took out the lymph nodes.
This is when they actually take off your entire muscle.
Actually,
of your skull.
A pretty long process. Yeah. It was the first craniotomy was an 8.5-hour surgery in which you're awake because they're showing you different things to color and look at them, and you have to make comments about them. And so the went through that process. And then having done that, we realized that melanoma is a brain-borne disease, and it's coming back. And so we had to find something that would deal with it, and we started looking all over the country for various experimental treatments.
Right.
And we found one in Dallas.
Right.
And we went to there, and
Baylor,
I was the first people.
Baylor University.
Baylor, yeah.
But what do you mean by experimental?
Clinical trial. He was...
Not only was it a clinical trial, but Brian was the first patient.
Oh, wow, okay.
Right. First human being, right?
Well, when we looked at what was going on 15 years ago in treating melanoma, it was clear that chemo didn't work. Radiation only had an effect on a particular tumor, but it wasn't going to stop the disease.
Sure.
And we needed to find something that would keep it at bay. And we went around and looked at various things, and this one seemed to have the most possible efficacy. Mm-hmm. So when they said to Brian, would you like to be the first patient, being that personality of a trial lawyer, he said, you bet.
And the doctor was from France, wasn't he? I think he was a French doctor. Is
that he was very good.
He was very good. Did you? Are you in touch with any of these folks at all, or exchange?
His name was Dr. Jacques Bonchereau.
Uh-huh. And I'm going to sip some French wine while you.
Absolutely, he would love that.
So, Doc, let's toast to the doctor.
And we still hear from Dr. McDermott, was the neurosurgeon up at University of San Francisco, mm-hmm. UCSF. And we get cards from him. We get calls from him on Thanksgiving, Christmas, and on St. Patrick's Day saying congratulations. You know, when you're a neurosurgeon or a doctor doing research, it's fabulous to see the results be positive for a change.
Yeah.
Neurosurgery is not an elective procedure, and most times the outcome is not what you always want it to be. So to have somebody 15 years later... Brian's just way out there.
I saw a special on the medical field once. It was a Harvard professor talking to his, I guess, freshman class or whatever, and he said 85% of medicine is guesswork. I'm going, oh, my God. that's encouraging. So obviously successful surgery, successful treatment. The day when you had a clean bill of health must have been a wonderful day for you, huh?
Well, there's now been... 15 years of those wonderful days.
Yeah.
I had the experimental treatment. I mean, I had the treatments looked at the other day, and they're clean again. That's 15 years.
Wow.
Congratulations.
And then we have to take our break right now. Gosh darn it. We'll come right back with more Fit Your Money Your Life right after this. Hang on. All right, we're back with Fit Your Money Your Life with Brian Monahan, Jerry Monahan, Richard Musio, myself, and their book, When a Loved One Falls Ill, How to Be an Effective Patient Advocate. And, Brian, you wanted to tell a story about that.
Well, we learned in the first book, Power of Two, they sent us around the country, our publisher did. And as we went through throughout the country, I learned something that Jerry knew ahead. Women mostly know ahead anyway. Mm-hmm. But learned that there were two parts of it. There was one of there's hope. That was my part. And mm-hmm. Jerry's part was there's a need for an advocate. And we realized that the more important part was an advocate. And Jerry became an advocate. I was a trial lawyer. I thought I could, you know, I was an advocate. But you cannot be an advocate for yourself. You need somebody to do it. And Jerry did a fabulous job. And could you comment about your...
Well, I think no matter, you can be a doctor, lawyer, Indian chief, but when you are faced with a diagnosis that pertains to you, life comes to a standstill. People might be telling you things, and you're not even hearing them correctly.
The stress and anxiety alone. You know,
absolutely. Yeah. So we learned that somebody sitting next to you, asking questions, that's absolutely vital, writing things down, because you might not understand everything then, but you can go home and look it up, and being the person who is willing to be the squeaky wheel.
Right.
Patients often feel that if they're the ones who ask a question, the doctor or the nurse will be angry with them, mm-hmm. and their care won't be as good. That's not true. But it's easier for a person outside the role of the patient to be the one to step forward.
So here's a funny advocate story. When I lost my eyesight, October 01, I went to see my eye surgeon, and they handed me some forms to fill out.
Good luck.
Good luck with that. Okay.
So the book has got about 50 great tips, the whole story about your illness and how you went through it successfully. And what would be the two or three of your favorite, most important tips?
The first one for me was trusting my intuition. I think people should trust their intuition. A mother knows more about what's going on with a child than a doctor does mm-hmm. who has just met the child for the first time. I knew when Brian was forgetting things in the last trial he had that there was something wrong.
Yeah.
And I believed that there was and trusted my intuition. I think it's vital. Tips were from the mundane to getting dressed up before you go to a doctor's office mm-hmm. so that you get better attention, you really do, mm-hmm. to getting a dog, which mm-hmm. is Brian's favorite mm-hmm. of the 50 tips. Mm-hmm. And our last one of making every day count. And understanding that this is not a dress rehearsal.
Right.
So, Jerry, how do you define the word courage?
How did I find it?
How do you define it?
I think courage is, I am the last person in the world to be able to ski down a black diamond slope. I'd stay there until the snow melted. I think courage is being able to find something within you that allows you to go outside who you are. I had no medical training. I didn't even pass my Girl Scout first aid badge, but I found the courage to ask the questions for the person I loved.
But you also had a mutual, respectful relationship, because so many times one spouse or the other will chime in something and they are put down or whatever, and it's not respected. You know, and that's not a successful relationship. Here is one where Brian and Jerry obviously respect each other, so you respect her opinion. And
yes, you do, don't you?
He's nodding his head yes.
At this point,
He's nodding his head yes.
And how long did the book take to write, and then who wrote most of it? Did you write most of it, Jerry, or just together you wrote it? Or
we wrote it together. Brian writes his part, and then I wrote my part. And then from that, when we had to edit it, then they came up with the idea of having the tips.
Yeah.
But it was a long, arduous process.
What do you think? Did you turn the mic off? Turn the mic back on.
Just pop up.
There we go.
I have a question for Brian. So toss that up. So, Brian, do you do something every day or fairly regularly that you didn't do before you had your medical issues? That's a sign of appreciation or something else?
Gets out of bed.
Like, for example, I never used to watch the sunset when I could see, and then after I lost my eyesight and it came back. Today I went and watched the sunset before I came over here.
I know we got a hip
in the same sense, I think every day I wake up and I think about what happened yesterday and mm-hmm. what's going to happen today, and everything is better. I mean, you really understand how incredible life can be. Mm-hmm. And when things get in your way, just push it aside, because there's so much happiness that has to hang around.
And
there.
On top of all this, you just had a hip replacement a couple years ago, right?
I've had a hip, knees, I've had everything you think.
You got to keep
the bionic man sitting next to me.
He's keeping the
health. Oh, when I walk into the doctor's office, especially the scientists, the neurosurgeons, they see me. It's just delightful for them. Because
I used to have a joke. I said it's not a good sign when the guy who is at the front of the parking garage at Scripps Hospital knows me by my first name.
So anyway, so you're off to a Christmas party or something like that, right? We're heading to another
one
tonight. It's great. A lot of and family coming out. I know how many grandkids.
We have seven grandkids.
Wow.
And, coming out for the holidays.
Right. Oh, yeah. And a wonderful dog.
Well, it's been an absolute pleasure to have you.
You didn't have a dog, though, before your medical issue?
No. Jerry had talked about that for a while, but I was a trial lawyer. I was going all the time. We were traveling. We were doing all kinds of things. Cancer slowed me down a little bit, you know. In fact, I had to get rid of my practice, all the other things, all the things I didn't need.
Yeah, your 30-year career. Do you miss practicing law at all, Brian?
Sometimes, but not much. Usually, I'll be asked to come down and meet with somebody who's got a case and help them out a little bit.
And then you got involved with the veterans. We've got about 30 seconds here, but tell us about the veterans that you work with. You work with the Wounded Warriors and all that?
I go to Wounded Warriors every Thursday, and I spend time with Wounded Warriors for the last 4 years now. And we provide feed for them, but mostly we sit and talk to them. We were there last night. Jerry and I were there last night for the Christmas party they had. So it's at Balboa Hospital. So you're with these kids that many of them lost their legs and arms
limbs,
and things like that, and they're just wonderful, absolutely wonderful, incredible people.
And then you were a key instigator in getting the Veterans Clinic at USD School of Law, which our second half of the show, we're going to talk to the director over there. So we'll thank you profusely in advance for all of that, you and Jerry. And it's been a real pleasure having you on the show, Brian and Jerry, and we'll see you again and have you back.
Brian, thanks
thank
for bringing
you
your
much.
Better half in. We very much appreciate it.
Happy holidays. We'll come right back with our second half of the show. Stick around. We are back with the award-winning Get Your Money on Your Life, and over to Richard to thank our wonderful sponsors.
By the way, that's multiple award-winning
Get
Your Money on Your Life.
That's right. Three-peat.
Three-peat, that's right.
With three first place.
Us and Phil Jackson.
Yes.
Or Michael Jordan or somebody.
Well, they had six. We got three more to go.
Yeah, but it was in two sets of three, so we're going to do that again, Joe.
You got it.
We're going to repeat our three-peat.
Fast track it.
That's
you
a repeat
it.
Of a three-peat. Anyway, thank you to lovely Lobby. This place is hopping tonight for the holidays.
Mm-hmm.
Tammy, thanks for the wine. Thanks for giving Joe something to drink. He is so much easier to be around when we're here than when we're at the studio when we have no wine.
Hosting Brian, Jerry, everybody.
So thank you to the lovely Lobby, Mark DiBella, Tammy Wong, and the crew. Also, our major sponsor, UBS, with Mr. Michael Caronta and Drew Freitas. Couldn't do it without you guys. Thanks so much. Jason Kruger with Signature Analytics, the best CFO company here on the West Coast. Right across the street from lovely Lobby, Regents Bank, Steve Sefton and Sean Puckett. Thank you, gentlemen. Carl Sheeler with Berkeley Research Group. I was just meeting with Carl yesterday in my office with a huge valuation case. Carl helps business owners improve the value of their businesses. Our favorite CPAs on the planet, Don Epic and Paul Polito CPA with Polito Epic CPAs up in Vista. Joel Grushkin with Cost Segregation Initiatives, helping real estate owners improve their cash flow. Brenda Geiger in the law offices of Brenda Geiger, also known as the Geiger Law Offices. That's one of our newest sponsors, but now we have a new one, even more recent than Brenda Geiger, the great estate planning attorney. That would be the Servant Leadership Institute. You may recall, Joe, when we had Art Varter,
correct,
their founder, on the show. They've got a great winter conference coming up in about a month and a half at the Omni Hotel in downtown San Diego on February 4th and 5th, servantleadershipinstitute.com. Some amazing speakers. Dick Enberg is going to be the kickoff speaker.
One of our guests.
Art Varter, who was also one of our guests. John Batchelor, Stephen Covey, C-O-V-E-Y.
Seven Habits of Highly
Effective People, and Dr. Ken Blanchard. So you talk about an all-star lineup of speakers at the Servant Leadership Institute's winter conference on February 4th and 5th.
Right.
So check that out. It's an amazing event.
And if they want more information about any of our sponsors, you folks can go over to iymoney.com, click on the sponsors tab. All of their personal information is there, their contact information. And I know Richard has had many successful outcomes with most all of them.
When we add up how much experience I have with them, cumulatively it's a number that is so high I don't want to mention it because it suggests that I have gray hair, which I do. And that's
always,
all I'm going to say.
Could always move the decimal point, Richard, at some point.
That's right. I'm an accountant, so 2 plus 2 is whatever I want it to be.
Anyway, for the second half of our show, we've got a very important guest, and he's related to our first two guests tonight, especially to Brian, because he is an adjunct professor of law at the University of San Diego.
Joe Torreros.
Yes, sir, which is Richard's alma mater, by the
yep.
way. And he has... he has been a judge advocate in the U.S. Marine Corps. He's got a great military career, which we can get into, but primarily this Veterans Clinic that he has started and is the director of at USD School of Law is very important, serving a lot of veterans who are having issues in the education, getting their education credits and benefits and everything else straightened out. So we welcome to our show Bob Muth. How are you tonight, Bob?
I'm doing great. Thank you very much for having me.
Yeah. Bob, sorry we gave you such a tough act to follow. Yeah. You're just going to have to do the best you can, my friend.
Well, Bob, talk a little bit about Brian Monahan and what he has meant to you and the organization, getting everything off the ground before we...
Sure. Brian and Jerry are phenomenal people, first of all, that needs to be said. And Brian specifically is a fantastic trial lawyer. Mm-hmm. He's a legend of the bar, mm-hmm. and he has been a great mentor to me and has been really an instigator of the Veterans Clinic at the University of San Diego School of Law.
Mm-hmm. And then how did you two meet initially? Because through his work with the veterans itself, and then he said, I want to help spearhead getting this clinic off the ground? Or
absolutely correct. He was he had recognized that there was a problem, and he was one of the original folks who had seen that there needed to be something done, and so he helped bring the clinic to being.
And the problem was and is?
Well, essentially what you have is you have a number of veterans, as they leave active duty, they have this fantastic educational benefit, and that's the post-9/11 GI Bill. And unfortunately, when you have such a wonderful benefit, there's always folks who will try to separate these folks from their benefits. And so what happens is a lot of for-profit education companies have tried to take advantage of veterans and essentially scam them out of their education benefits.
And how do they typically attempt to scam them? Because I see it happening all the time.
Sure. It's you know, first and foremost, there's exceptionally aggressive recruiting tactics, which is not necessarily different from how they go about trying to get civilian students. But the veterans are a particular focus because of something that sounds very complicated, but it's really simple. It's this thing called the 90-10 rule, which essentially says that if you're a for-profit school, you have to derive no more than 90% of your revenue from federal sources. However, the post-9/11 GI Bill doesn't count as federal sources, as mm-hmm. inexplicable as that is, mm-hmm. because of a problem with the law. Mm-hmm. And so what ends up happening is they can bring these veterans in and they count towards that 10% of the ledger, which is oftentimes a problem for the for-profit schools. And mm-hmm. so therefore, when you bring in one veteran, you can bring in nine other people who are exclusively on federal funds.
Hmm. How about that? So how many veterans have you been able to serve since you've opened the doors? It's been just about a year and a half or so? Or
yeah, it's been just about 18 months, mm-hmm. and we've taken on between 20 and 30 individual clients. However, we also do two other things. We go out and do quite an enormous number of outreach events where we'll go to veteran service organizations or to active duty military bases or other places where we find veterans or active duty military people. Mm-hmm. And we will provide educational briefs, essentially like between a half hour and an hour, mm-hmm. and just to advise them on their benefits, but more importantly to talk about some of the common pitfalls that veterans face when they try to use those benefits. So in that context, we probably talk to thousands of veterans.
And do you attempt to exert any influence over institutions that have a track record of not being, shall we say, as moral and ethical as they should be?
Well, we have actually at the University of San Diego, we have a broader initiative to protect student veterans. So my Veterans Clinic is one component of that, but we also have an advocacy piece run by Professor Bob Felmuth. And in that capacity, we've been trying to change the laws in Sacramento and in Washington to try to rein in some of the bigger abuses. But we also can exert pressure by suing people. So that's the other strategy.
Right.
And let's give your website, Bob, before I forget. It's sandiegoedu.com/ what, Veterans Clinic?
Veterans Clinic, all okay. One word, Veterans
yeah.
Clinic.
Yep. Okay, with a forward slash in there, right?
That's right. And if you just go to Google, you type it in, you'll see our Facebook page and Twitter page as well.
Or just Google his name, M-U-T-H, Bob Muth, and I'm sure you'll find the right website and the right contact information there. So, but so you also teach at the school, or?
Well, I do. As part of the Veterans Clinic, we have a class component. So it meets once a week, and we discuss primarily civil litigation topics that are mm-hmm. going to be applicable in the cases that the students are going to handle. So mm-hmm. the way we kind of run the clinic is the students are the primary point of contact for the veterans. They do most of the work on the cases, and I supervise them. And that way, the veterans are able to get great, dedicated, motivated legal assistance, and the students at the law school are also able to get experience, real-world practical experience.
And when a veteran's had a bad experience, what do you attempt to do? Do you attempt to get his money back or her money back? Or what usually is the end objective of the representation?
The ultimate goal is to, it depends on the specific case, but ultimately the goal is to try to get the money back. And so sometimes that can be done just by sending a demand letter, mm-hmm. and nobody really wants to get sued by a veterans clinic.
Right.
And sometimes it's, you know, we have to go further than that.
Mm-hmm. Have you made any good inroads in lobbying in Washington at all?
Well, we have. There was a thing called the Block Bill that was passed in Sacramento specifically. That's where we've had our greatest successes. And in that capacity, Professor Felmuth and his team has been able to push to have essentially more disclosure from the schools. That's been one of the biggest focuses, mm-hmm. is just making sure that they're actually putting out accurate statistics that are comprehensible to a regular person. Mm-hmm. And that way people can make an informed decision.
A lot of folks don't know that some of these for-profit schools have large marketing departments, boiler room operations, for it might be another way to term it, but they have hundreds of people just making calls all day. They target the veterans, and isn't that pretty much what it is? And bombarding with phone calls until they get what they want?
That's absolutely correct. I mean, you have some of these are, many of them are publicly traded companies who, if you actually were to look at their budgets, reminded of Tip O'Neill's famous statement, don't tell me what your priorities are, show me your budget and I'll tell you what your priorities are. And, mm-hmm. and their priorities are more than half of their revenue will ultimately go to profits and marketing. Yeah. So when you're doing that, you're not spending the money on education.
And don't you find that a lot of veterans, when they come back, have difficulty making good decisions because they tend to come out of very high-stress situations? Adjusting to regular life is very, very difficult.
Well, I think each veteran's case is going to be unique. However, most of our clients, and generally speaking with a lot of the younger veterans that are leaving active duty, they're the first person in their family who's gone to will be going to college. They're at least 4 years removed from high school, so they don't have like a trusted teacher or somebody that they can rely on.
Because this concept of advocacy,
advocate.
To me, it would really apply.
Absolutely.
But anyway, let's take a break right there, folks, and we'll come right back with more of It's Your Money in Your Life live from LaVie right after this. Hang on. All right, we are back with our guest, Bob Muth, Professor Bob Muth at USD School of Law. He is head of the Veterans Legal Affairs Clinic and supervising attorney there. He's a graduate of Northwestern as an undergrad and got his law degree at Duke. So welcome back, Bob.
Thank you.
Yeah, where do we leave off, Richard?
Well, I wanted to ask, when a young man or woman comes out of the military, they're usually, like you said, 22, 23 years old, maybe 4 years removed from high school, maybe a little bit more. What's some of the due diligence that they should do on these educational institutions before they make a commitment or a decision? I mean, what are the most important attributes to look at, in your opinion?
That's a fantastic question. I think the first thing they need to do is take a look at a website called College Navigator, which is done through, just go to Google and type in College Navigator, and you'll look for the one through the Department of Education. It allows you to compare apples to apples and oranges to oranges. So it lets the individual veteran look up and line up the graduation rates at the different schools. They can look at what's called loan cohort default rates, which is just a fancy way of saying how many people are not paying their loans back mm-hmm. after 3 years, which is a good way to get a feel for, are their students able to get jobs? If they're not able to pay their loans, they're probably not able to get jobs. And then also they can look at things like, are they accredited? And there's different types of accreditation. So there's regional and national accreditation. And most folks would assume, I think, that national accreditation is better. However, actually, regional accreditation is the way to go. So they should look at whether or not the institution...
Why is regional better than national? Because that's counterintuitive to me.
Sure. Well, regional accreditation is what most of the schools you think of when you think of a traditional brick-and-mortar school, that's what they have. And the big difference, it gets to the quality of the education. There's certain vetting process that goes on. But for the individual veteran's perspective, the reason it matters is, generally speaking, regionally accredited schools, like all your state schools, your community colleges, your big nonprofit private schools, those schools will only take credits oftentimes from other regionally accredited schools. So if you are a nationally accredited school, which originally grew up as part of like a trade school, mm-hmm. essentially, it was a way for them to regulate the auto school or whatever, which is fine. But nowadays they're moving into these four-year bachelor's degrees from nationally accredited schools. And it turns out that a lot of the veterans, when they think they're going to be able to go for 2 years and then transfer to a quote-unquote real school, what ends up happening instead is their credits don't transfer, and now they're in a real bind.
So no money and no credits.
Exactly. And then they've got to decide, am I going to double down on a bad investment in the first place, or am I going to just walk away and now have to start over completely fresh at a new school with half the benefits that they had originally?
Wow. So the cases you represent, do you think you'll be staying in touch with the people you represented, like sort of in a mentoring capacity as the years go by? I'm just curious, because I know you're so new. This program is only a couple of years old.
Sure. I mean, that's the goal. And really what we're trying to do with the individual vets is we try to help them out with the specific problem they have and then also give them some of the tools that we think would be helpful to make good decisions for their education benefits now that, when they get the money back.
Hmm. You have some success stories that you can tell us about? There must be a few people that have had some good outcomes, right?
We do, and unfortunately, most of our cases so far have settled. So we, as part of the settlement process, we have to agree not to disclose specific details of the cases. But we've had some individuals who've been able to get significant amounts of money back, basically everything they had paid, and then go and move to a different school. In the individual case I'm thinking of right off the top of my head, he just went to a state school. It was one of the local state schools that he wanted to go to, and he's doing fantastic now. So, you know, that's the goal.
And for our listeners, I mean, these for-profit schools are publicly traded. You can buy stock in them as opposed to, can you imagine Notre Dame, Stanford, or Berkeley or someplace? You know, they're not traded on the New York Stock Exchange.
Or their chancellor making $25 million a year.
Yes. I mean, what's wrong with this picture? So you got to, at some point, believe that, like you said, show me your budget and I'll show you tell you your priorities. So, I mean, they should be, most schools should be about benefiting the students in the best possible way, but I guess it doesn't always work that way.
So, Bob, did your career as in the Marine Corps, I know you were a judge advocate there. Did that help you in what you're doing now, or is that totally and completely separate and distinct and different?
Well, the type of law is different, but it's really allowed me to make a quick connection, I think, with the veterans. A lot of times veterans, they trust other veterans. And unfortunately, that's actually what a lot of the for-profit schools will do, is they'll hire veterans in order to try to recruit them in, because there's a certain trust when a guy starts talking your language. You just feel like he's going to have your best interest at heart. So I think that's been really helpful with my military background.
That's great.
So did you enjoy being in the Marine?
I loved it. Marine Corps was fantastic. I mean, the slogan is it changes forever. And it really is. I mean, it's a way to change your whole outlook on life.
Yeah, because we've got General Brahms on in about, I think, 4 weeks on the show.
He's a great man. Great man. We both had a case together not that long ago, about 4 or 5 years ago.
He's got a real cool charity going on called missionreadiness.org, which is trying to combat the fact that many, many young people can't even qualify to get in the military now because of poor physical condition and or inability to even meet minimum requirements with math and English. So it's a neat program, but we'll talk about that when he comes on. Great guy.
Sounds great.
What was your case about briefly?
That case I had with General Wells? Yeah. We both had there was a case that arose out of an alleged massacre at Haditha, which was a big case. It was cover of Time magazine.
I remember that.
It was everywhere, and I represented the company commander and he had the platoon commander. So our cases were very intertwined
With what kind of Haditha you said? What did the case deal with?
Oh, the city in Iraq was called Haditha.
Haditha. Okay.
Alleged massacre.
That was big news.
It was a big case.
So, you're representing a really great cause, but your entity's fairly new. How do you see this thing looking in 5 or 10 years? Veterans Clinic.
Well, I think we're going to continue on with the for-profit education issues being front and center because it's just such a need, and we're the only veterans clinic in the country that's doing this specific type of case. And then I think we'll, as time goes on, expand into a couple other areas that we feel are particularly important in the San Diego community with the large veteran population. Mm-hmm. So that would be most likely looking at the potential for discharge upgrades for folks who might have been separated under less than honorable conditions.
Sure.
And then also most pressing as well would be looking at trying to represent veterans in their disability appeals. So there's a huge backlog in the VA disability system, and a lot of folks kind of just got pushed through, and a lot of them deserved better than that. So we'll be trying to assist them in the appeals too.
And then how many students are working with you, and how big is your clinic right now in terms of how many law students and staff and whatnot?
Sure. Generally, we have between 6 and 8 students. And so in the students oftentimes are veterans themselves. So if you were to look at my clinic right now, I have a retired lieutenant colonel who's going to get his law degree. I have a lieutenant commander. I have a major in the Marine Corps. And then I also have a captain in the Army. So we've got everything except the Air Force. I got to find one of them. So they're motivated to assist, and the clients trust them.
But we've got to find better advocacy for getting our veterans jobs when they come back, because you've got people who've led 100 people in charge of millions of dollars of machinery, and nobody wants to hire them because they don't really place much value in what they did in the military.
Well, our friend Nathan Fletcher's doing pretty well over at Qualcomm, but we certainly were advocating for him to be our next mayor. But, hey, maybe better luck next time. Who knows? But he was.
Because, half of my volunteers at my Oceanside Turkey Trot come off of Camp Pendleton. They're the best volunteers on the planet. So thanks, men and women up there, because you guys do amazing work. Not just serving our country, but on Thanksgiving morning for what you do for the Oceanside community.
I'll tell you one thing. When you hire a Marine or anybody, they are always on time. And I know that's a big problem with a lot of workers today, a lot of tardiness. But they're always on time. But it's time for us to wrap it up here, Bob. So thank you so much for being our guest tonight. Thank you to Brian and Jerry.
Bob, appreciate it. Also, thanks for your service.
Yes.
Thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you, Richard, for a great show. Tammy Wong, thanks for opening up tonight. And
Joe, are you taking the wine home?
I think I just might do that. Anyway, thanks to Justin Hart in the studio for making us sound good. And to Craig
and J.W. Blank. August, thank you. But we're not going to tell anybody why. But J.W., thank you.
Next week we'll All do right. that. And thanks to Craig Blanke, our con executive, and Dave Sniff, our programming genius. You guys have a great week. And don't forget to go to sanigo.edu/veterans clinic for Bob's clinic in whenaloveonefallsill.com for Brian and Jerry's book. Good night and have a great week. We'll see you next time.